counsel. May you proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Joseph M. Aliotto. I am one of the representatives of the plaintiff below and the appellant here. I'm here with Mr. Dombrowski. I serve on this case by grace of the court under Pro Hoc Vice. I would like to reserve, if it please your honors, 10 minutes for rebuttal. And my understanding is that the yellow light will go off at 15 and the red light at 20 minutes, I think. Okay, thank you very much. We have four items that we are presenting to the court, four issues with regard to decisions coming from the court below. The first, of course, is with regard to the jury issue. And we submit that, in the first place, that the court has never discharged that jury. As a matter of fact, that jury still exists under the control of the court. And secondly, even if it had discharged the jury, which it did not, the law is, under many of the decisions which we have cited to the court, that it's used in a common sense view as to whether or not the court still has control, and also whether or not any of the jurors have been contaminated. And what we have pointed out in our attachments is that the court was very clear, the court below was very clear, to make sure that no one was contaminated, nor would they be contaminated, and that they had not even discussed it among or between themselves, and that the court's inquiry, when the court originally found out that there was a problem, that the court's inquiry was confined to what their verdicts were, not why there was no intrusion into the thought processes of any of the jurors.
Counsel, if the jury wasn't discharged, it would have been improper for a judge to sit and meet with them privately without counsel and discuss the case, wouldn't it?
The court did not meet with them privately, Your Honor. The court met with each one of them in open court. The court had gone into the jury room after the verdict, and after the court originally said they were discharged. And this is very close to the same case that we have pointed out in which the judge did that in Atwood.
The judge didn't discuss anything with them in the jury room?
We asked for, in all due respect to the trial court, we didn't know what he asked, and we didn't know what he said. And under the rules, we had to actually file a motion for recusal because we thought he was a witness to tell us. He did not want to tell us. So we thought he became a witness if it were an issue. Judge August denied that, so we don't know the answer to Your Honor's question. But
had the jury not been discharged, it would have been improper for him, right, to discuss the case with the jury without counsel?
If the jury had not been discharged?
If the jury had been discharged, excuse me, not been discharged, it would have been improper for him to meet privately with the jury.
I don't know whether the court discussed the case. All I know is that the court came back and was concerned that there was a problem with the verdict. And we do not know. We could speculate as to what the judge said. We could speculate what the jurors said, but we didn't know. We thought we maybe had to do that. So that's why we had to do the course that we chose. We didn't intend to recuse the judge because there was any reason other than we thought that he had to be a witness.
Thank you.
Also, I think that the inquiry, when each of the jurors came in, it was kind of, or very close to, and we take the position it was, a repolling. And the court only asked, is this your verdict? And the jurors, at least seven of them said no, it was not. The judge did not ask why, the judge did not ask how. The judge didn't even say, there was no even questions. We wanted a question that the judge did not ask. And that was whether any of them actually saw the verdict, or whether they were just giving what their view was, and then the foreman was putting it down.
But there was nothing new, counsel. Isn't it true, before the jury may have been discharged, they came into the courtroom, they were polled, this is your verdict. The verdict was clear to everyone in the courtroom. Nobody raised an issue, and then they were discharged, right?
Correct. And then the jury went into their room. The judge, according to his usual practice, and the practice as we've shown in other cases, Your Honor, where other judges have done that, they go in to thank the jury. Then we heard word that the court wanted us back. That's it. When we came back, the court said, I'm not going to tell you what we talked about, but we'll have briefs about it. And he brought in the jury again. And then when he brought the jury back in, he specifically said that he had given them a discharge and he was rescinding that instruction. Now that, the judge said it very
rescinding
specific.
The discharge or rescinding the discharge or rescinding the instruction about discussing the case?
I think it is important to read what the judge said. These are the final instructions, Your Honor, that were given to the jury after when the jury was called back. At page 6 of that instruction, the court said, "I'm going to need," he began on page 5. "Realistically, I think all you can brief at this point," that was the last thing that was said. And then the court said, in calling the jury, starting on page 5, "All right, the record will reflect the presence of the members of the jury. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, earlier I gave you an instruction and I'm going to need to rescind that. So that's the reason we had you return to the courtroom. Otherwise, there's nothing that you need be concerned with. And that is, I read you an instruction that began, quote, after you have been discharged from your jury service in this case, you are free to discuss this case with anyone, end of quote. And I went through the balance of the instruction. I'm going to rescind that and instruct you that at this point you are not free to discuss this case with anyone. So the obvious antecedent for that is the entire instruction. He did it again later, and later when after he had interviewed each of the jurors, we had what's called the transcript of the proceedings, and this is after the instruction with them. And at that time at page 27, the court said, and one of the jurors asked, but at that time the court said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm about to excuse you for the day, but I am going to continue my order relative to not discussing this case with anyone or allowing anyone to discuss the case with you. So please keep that in mind. Please do not read, listen, or watch any news accounts that might discuss this case if there are any." That is the contamination issue as well, which, by the way, each of the jurors admitted when each was brought before all of us singly. Okay. Then the court said, so again, I thank you very much, and at this time you can go home and we will, at the appropriate time, keep you advised of where we stand in terms of the status of the case. All right. And then one juror says, so we'll have to come back. And the court said, I guess I can't say one way or the other. I know you've gone above and beyond the call, so try to do what is appropriate under the circumstances. I can't tell you that you won't be summoned back, but we'll just have to see. So I'm sorry, I can't give you more of an answer than that. Okay, so each of the jurors were still under the control of the court, effectively, and at no time did the court tell them, so far as we can see anyway, that you are discharged, you're finished with this case. To the contrary, the court was saying exactly the opposite, and as a matter of fact, the jurors still remain under the control of the court.
Counsel, what's the significance of the discharge question to the issue of whether or not the trial court can amend the judgment?
Let us say that the Court of Appeals in the Cabral case made it significant. And certain of the other courts have also made it significant. But the newer courts and the newer claims do not. And so they're saying, in effect, if you are in control, still in control, and not contaminated, both of which are present here, then the court still has the right to be able to do that, according to the decisions that we have cited to Your Honor. Also, the recent Supreme Court decision, which, by the way, was first decided apparently by this court, also began to use as finally as formal part of the law of Hawaii the Duck case out of the Ninth Circuit. And this court itself favorably cited it, which the court below would not accept. This court favorably cited it in this court's decision, which was reversed on other grounds. And the Supreme Court specifically referred to Duck again. And the whole point of it was is that these inquiries are what is the verdict, and not why or how. Specifically, if I might, I would direct the court's attention to the Supreme Court's most recent decision in October of 2011. And at that time, the court, citing Duck, and then also stating that this court itself apparently had also cited Duck, and that the pages that they have here are, this is the modern way they do this, so you don't have the usual form of books. But I will say that at page 11, and this is from the Hawaii 125, Hawaii 446, which is 263 Pacific 3rd, 726. And the court said at that time, as to the petitioner's first contention that the court should have ordered a new trial rather than give the supplemental instruction, which this court approved, the ICA reasoned that, quote, it was within the court's authority to provide a supplemental jury instruction and verdict form to correct the inconsistency of the verdict. Because, one, the court saw that the general damage award was inconsistent with special damages, and two, when an ambiguous or improper verdict is returned by the jury, the court should permit the jury to correct the mistake before it is discharged. That was the original language. That was the discharge language in Duck. And then it said that apparently the court had cited Duck. And this Supreme Court went on, was relevant insofar as it indicated that allowing the jury to correct its mistakes conserves judicial resources and the time and convenience of the citizen jurors and the parties. And it is presumed that the jurors will properly perform their duties and not subvert the law.
Now, in that case, and I remember it well because I was vacated in part, the special verdict form was, as a matter of law, incorrect, because the Supreme Court ruled that if you award general and special, if you award certain damages, you have to give something in terms of nominal. They just said, on its face, as a matter of law, it's not right, and they sent it back, right?
Correct, except that they decided it on the basis of the facts.
But this verdict on its face is not legally incorrect. Right? They are just answering the questions.
That brings up another question, which I think is interesting in itself. Is the verdict itself inconsistent? It is inconsistent to the extent, and one of the jurors specifically said this, it is inconsistent to the extent that they went through the time and trouble after the 8-week trial to determine whether there was interference, to determine the amount of the damages, to determine the causation, to determine that, in fact, the bank acted oppressively, maliciously, and wantonly, to determine, in fact, that there were punitive damages which they assessed. All of the causes, all the elements of our cause of action were determined. The only one that wasn't, where the mistake was the statute of limitations, and as we say, the jurors came in and said that was a mistake. Now, in that situation, is it inconsistent?
Well, the special verdict form could have been arranged differently. First question, statute of limitations. You know, if you answer so-and-so, stop right there and don't get to the next. But they were just following the special verdict form as it was presented to them.
Correct, Your Honor. But the question that the court asks is whether or not there was an inconsistency. And I say fundamentally, as one of the jurors said, do you think that we would have done that and then said there was no cause of action?
But not on its face. That's why you brought the jurors in to have them explain their thought process.
No, we did not ask them to explain their thought processes, Your Honor. And as a matter of fact, the court was very clear that they were not going to be asked that. They were asked, what is your verdict? Was this your verdict? The first one, no. The second one, no. What's the matter with it? Number seven was wrong. That's a mistake. And then some of them stated clearly, there was no question that the statute of limitations had not run. That's the way they did it. And so that's why we wanted to know when they were talking and when they said, the juror said, well, we agree it had not run. When they had said that, then I wanted the court to ask the jurors Ask the foreman, did you see the verdict? Or were you just telling the foreman and he was writing it, checking yes or no, or whatever? And but the court didn't decline to do that. But the fact of the matter is that they have not proved their affirmative defense. I think it's definitely a polling. Mr. Lowenthal said believed it was a polling, and I believe that was a correct analysis. At the time, I was not there when the jury verdict was received. But it was a polling because the court was saying strictly, although it said before, saying it again, is this your verdict? And they said no. And more than 7 or 8 or whatever it was.
But this all hinges on whether or not the jury was actually discharged.
Pardon me?
This all hinges on whether or not the jury was actually discharged prior to being brought in.
Well, I respectfully disagree with that because I don't think that that is the requirement of the law. As the cases that we have pointed out is, it's functional. And so the question is, are they still under the control of the court? And the second question is, have they been contaminated? And we have shown that neither of those occasions took place.
Well, we don't know about the contamination, do we? We don't know what went on in that jury room.
No, we do know about the contamination, Your Honor, because the court specifically asked the jurors, had you read anything? Were you influenced by anything? Was anything? Tell us. And they each said no. And then, as I just read to the court, when the jurors were finally excused, and one juror says, we have to come back, the court again said, don't talk about it, don't read it, don't talk to each other about it. And they all said that. So, when they came back, they're still under a verdict, which means, of course, speak the truth, or it might be even considered to be a voir dire, which means the same thing, only it's French, but it means the same. Is what is the fact? What is the truth? And so they told him what the truth was.
So if a judge meets privately with the jurors in a room and there's no evidence of what was discussed, that couldn't possibly be contamination.
Not according to what the courts have said. And as we pointed out, the practice of Judge Cardozo was no different. Many judges, apparently, after a jury trial, will go in and congratulate the jurors. Thank you very much, and we appreciate your service. And it was at that time that the court came out. The court never said what it did. We had attempted to inquire about it. Okay, we weren't allowed to inquire.
That's the point. We don't know.
Well, then you cannot speculate, Your Honor. What we do know is what the jurors said when they were asked a specific question by the court. Was this your verdict? No. Okay. It's not their verdict. And under the law, we would submit that the judgment should be reinstated for the plaintiff. They didn't prove their affirmative defense. Now, I believe also that we could ask it to be resubmitted, notwithstanding the time period, because they were on call and still remain on call.
Wouldn't there be a little contamination now, though?
I don't think so. All they have to do is answer the question at a voir dire with the judge. And if they say that they have not been contaminated, and I don't see how they could be because the court told them not to read about anything or anything like that, then they could be called back. And if they're called back, even over this time period, rather than doing a full 8 weeks again, the whole purpose of Duck and this court's decision, even in that same case, using Duck, is that this is a matter of convenience, this is a matter of judicial economy, and this is a matter of justice. And so it's a matter of Rule 1. So we think that they have not proven their case, but if there be a retrial, it may have to be for the 8 weeks again. That's not necessary. All that would need to be done is that we could re-argue the case to the jury for an hour or so on that one issue, and just refresh their recollection. The three other points that we have brought before the court, one of them is particularly annoying, and that is where the chief executive officer of this defendant bank testified that, in fact, he had a fiduciary duty to our client, but failed to disclose and make important disclosures to us, and then after he was confronted with that and had to admit it, then he comes back and he says, and he tries to designate Hawaii as a state in which fiduciary duty is determined by the big F or the small F, an invention of his mind, and as an excuse to get out of the testimony that he gave.
But his opinion on what a legal fiduciary duty is doesn't matter, does it? Just his opinion.
He said that he owed a fiduciary duty to us.
And that created it? By that statement created that, regardless of the relationship?
What it created was a question of fact under the law given by the judge. But the judge refused that and instead granted a directed verdict. notwithstanding that admission by the chief executive officer. And throughout the trial, as the court can see from our briefs, fiduciary relationship was a major issue that they tried to say for their investors, even though they lied to their investors as well, when they took our property without advising them about the option or anything else. I do wish to reserve my 10 minutes, if I might. The last two questions were evidentiary. One was on the attorney-client, but more importantly was the one under 408, in which their lawyer is telling the bank, don't go through the option, don't attempt to try to get these people who are going to buy it, because we want to buy it, and we want to keep it to be able to have it in fee to sell for ourselves.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Toole.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to begin simply by introducing our client representatives here, if I might, right? And that is Mark Lawson, who's the vice chair and general counsel of the bank, who's sitting there, and Sharon Online, who's a vice president and litigation manager, who had the pleasure of sitting through this 8-week trial in Maui with us. I would like to begin as follows. I'd like to offer some introductory comments before going to the specifics. I'd then like to do something I hadn't planned on doing, but there were several questions that were asked during Mr. Aliotto's opening, and I'd like to address those because I think the answers are clear, and then I may come back to them, but I think they're black and white. I don't think there's any gray in much of anything we have in front of us today.
Counsel, if I could, and I apologize for this. Your approach sounds fine, but I had a question for the appellant's counsel. I didn't want to take his last minute and ask him this.
Sure.
It's unclear from the record to me. Both the parties talk about the defendant as a whole. There's four entities involved
yes.
here. And for instance, Mr. Weir is a former CEO of something, but we don't know. And sometimes that's relevant. If you might be specific in talking about people, it might help us in terms of our
I would be happy to do that. And on that particular point, Mr. Weir was at the time of the events here with Bank of Hawaii. He was basically an officer who was in charge of the trust department. He was not the CEO of the bank. And I'm happy if I am not specific, please ask me, but I'll try to be precise. With respect to my opening comments, I think this case presents a couple of opportunities here for this court that would be good for the jurisdiction, would be good for the judges who are trying the cases, and I think it would be very good for the lawyers who are trying the cases as well. And that is, we have an issue in front of you, which you get from time to time, and certainly did in Kanahele, which deals with the sanctity of the jury process and jury verdicts. And it is, in my opinion, a crime if there's not certainty as to what the guidelines are and the rules are here. And I would simply suggest that that is a process that has enjoyed sanctity. It is jealously guarded, and I'll address that in some of my remarks, but I think the public policy considerations here are huge. And we can see that in cases like this, it's easy to throw oatmeal in the fan and start to scramble some ideas between is a jury discharged? What are the exceptions to the almost per se rule that you don't set aside a jury verdict? And I want to address those, but my general point is that I think it's for this court and for our jurisdiction really huge to have the clarity, and I would like to express my views on what that is in the framework of this appeal. The second one, which I think is pragmatic, but it's equally important, and that is the issues of when are summary judgments appropriate, when are judgments as a matter of law or judgments on the pleading appropriate, to avoid, as we would argue here, a case that goes for 8 weeks, or at least a case that goes for 8 weeks on issues that should have been disposed of early. And I believe, although this is just my view as being a practitioner in front of the courts, that many of the circuit court judges, unlike the federal court where you kind of got the lifetime tenure, are really loath to grant summary judgments. There's the fear of getting reversed. And, you know, some guidelines here would be perfect. And I would suggest to the three of you, respectfully, that this is a case on the issues relating to the tortious interference, that you've got an absolutely pristine field with uncontroverted evidence where the trial court should have and could have granted those motions and not even had this go to the jury to even get into the issue of the statute of limitations. So those are my openers. I'd like now, if it's okay with the court, just to respond, if I could, as directly as possible to the questions that were asked. The first question, I believe, Judge Foley, you asked, and that is whether Judge Cardoza met with the jury on the same day of the jury verdict? And the answer is yes, he did. He went into the jury room. The record is absolutely clear that we and other counsel wanted to talk to the jury. He was clear in saying, okay, but I give the jurors the respect of asking them whether they want to talk to you. He went in to talk to them. He told us he talked to them. And then he asked whether we wanted to hear what he had to say, and I said no. That at this point, it was discharged, and certainly let's not cloud the record. The jurors who were subsequently colloquied a month, more than a month later, a month and a half later, were clear in the colloquy that what they learned as a result of that is that there was a statute of limitations that had run and that they, quote, checked the wrong box. So that information, they said, came from the judge. There was nothing in question 7 under prospective interference that says statute of limitations. Now, we argued that in closing. It was an important point. There was absolutely uncontradicted evidence that there was a statute of limitations issue, and in fact, it was crystal clear and uncontradicted. So I would just answer to you, Judge, that there was a meeting. We certainly can discern from the totality of the record what was discussed, and therein you've got the potential for contamination. The discharge issue, I think, has come up a couple of different times, and I would simply say that he did discharge him. His instructions, while you can mince words about whether his telling the jury not to talk was also a rescinding of the discharge, he didn't say that. If he wanted to say, I'm rescinding the discharge, he could have said it. He's a very capable judge. In fact, later on, the record is clear. He said, I never rescinded that. I called the jury back to colloquy, and I wanted to have a complete record. Now, whether he should have done it or shouldn't have done it, who knows? Judge Joel August looked at it and said, should have never gone there, no reason to do it, but we have what we have, and it doesn't change things. And, Your Honor, you asked the question about what difference does it make if there was a discharge? And I think the discharge, unfortunately, gets blended into some other issues, which you've got to ask the questions that precede it. But I think the discharge issue, it's not a mystery. When the judge discharges the jury, he discharges the jury. The Connecticut case that's cited by counsel is totally an opposite. It deals with the statute. It deals with whether there was in a criminal case, an individual polling of a jury that was requested before discharge. I mean, it just doesn't apply here. So I think the discharge issue is relevant as to whether there was potential for contamination after the fact, which is a real issue here. And I think it speaks to the issue of clean up your business before you discharge the jury. If there's something inconsistent on the face of the verdict or something that's a clerical error, you deal with it. I think that's the policy. You don't get to a situation like this. So I would suggest that that's relevant, but we come to some other points as well. I'm going to come back to Conahelli. Jury wasn't discharged. You're obviously, know the case better than we do. It doesn't deal with anything here. It simply is a matter of law. The verdict where there's no general damages but specials is inconsistent on its face and has to be dealt with. It was dealt with, and the remand was simply whether by giving him $1 for generals is sufficient to cure it. And Justice Jacoba said no, but it doesn't guide us here, I don't believe. This verdict form is not inconsistent on its face. It was negotiated by counsel. It could have been done a lot of different ways, but it was clear. I mean, it was absolutely clear what the jury was being asked to do, and it's a special verdict form. They were asked to find a fact. All of the arguments you heard this morning about how the jurors said it wasn't their decision, well, you could tell from the colloquy that their surprise was exactly as in Cabral. My God, we checked the wrong box because we wanted these guys to get money. But their job wasn't to decide whether they got money. Their job was to decide the fact of whether the statute of limitations had run. They made that decision. They learned quite clearly from Judge Cardoza after the fact that the legal result of that was what it was, which means there is no damages. But that's clearly under all the case law in the jurisdiction of this state in Cabral is, the jurors don't get to decide what the result is legally. So I think I've essentially covered the questions that you raised, and I'd like to go back to what I think is extremely important, and I would just, some of it was briefed, some of it was afterwards, and I'm not trying to suggest that there's cases that need to be studied here, but I would like to start out with our thinking as we looked at the whole issue of why is this thing about the jury process and the jury verdict so important, and it's this. This policy goes back over 200 years, and it's amazing. I don't normally refer to cases that go back to 1785 and I'm going to refer to a Supreme Court that's 1915, but the fact of the matter is that's where the policy started. And Lord Mansfield in England, in the case of Vase versus de Laval, refused to accept testimony of a juror that the verdict had been made by lot. And as you're probably familiar with that, the jurors basically, some of them picked a number here, picked a number there, they averaged it, and who knows what they came up with. But In that case, Lord Mansfield said, I'm not going to let evidence in from a juror to talk about something screwed up in the jury process. That has been the continuing policy. It's a bright line. It's virtually a per se rule. It has remained the law today. And the Supreme Court in Donald versus Pleth, and Mark Bennett, my partner, called me yesterday. He says, look, you got to read this. And it has to do with exactly that point. It is a 1915 Supreme Court case. And it talks about Lord Mansfield. And the important consideration is it talks about the policy. And it says, while it may often exclude, that is the rule, the bright line that you don't go and let jurors impeach their testimony, and I'm not talking about clerical errors, I'm talking about jurors trying to unwind what they've done. While it may often exclude the only possible evidence of misconduct, a change in the rule would open the door to the most pernicious acts in tampering with jurors. The practice would be replete with dangerous consequences. It would lead to the grossest fraud and abuse, and no verdict would be safe, and that's true. And that's why, up to this day, that's been relied on. I think it's clearly the way the rule reads here. I was interested to go back and look at Rule 606 of the federal rules and the Hawaii rules. A little bit different. They refer to Lord Mansfield. They go back to the same policy. And what do they talk about in terms of juror testimony? A very narrow exception. And that really is, in this state, I believe, because the federal rule is a little different, that if there are external conditions that would cause something to go wrong in the jury room, somebody's drinking, outside influence, tampering, you know, you gotta figure that one out. I mean, but that's not what we have here. And then in the federal cases, you get into another exception, which is one that says, if there's a mistake. Well, lo and behold, it was interesting to read, because the two cases cited by the appellant, they start out with one case, and then in the reply, they come back with Attridge and McCullough, Second Circuit and Sixth Circuit, which redo the verdict under where there was confusion on comparative negligence. And I know, you know, your honors have read that. Well, the advisory committee notes to the federal rule 606B looked at those cases. In fact, it cites Attridge and said, we specifically decline to follow that. That is not what the rule is intended. The rule is intended to deal with clerical error. That is, I'm a juror, I say yes, and somehow the foreman writes down no. That's a clerical error. That's what the federal rule, which is more expansive than the Hawaii rule, is intended to say. And I would simply suggest that I'm not going to argue a lot about Attridge and McCullough. They're in opposite here. They're simply in opposite. The court went too far. The Federal Advisory Committee think they went too far as well. So, and then we come again, and this is kind of at the 50,000-foot level, the whole idea of a special verdict. There's another overlay there. This is not a general verdict. This is a special verdict. And I think, Judge Foley, as you said, they were asked to find a fact. They found the fact, didn't like the result of the fact, and, you know, we got Cabral to answer that. So this is not complicated. So I would suggest here, while we may talk about issues of jury discharge, whether Judge Cardozo met with somebody, didn't meet with him, what was it, the issues are clear. You've got to go through the checklist, and the checklist is you take a look at what are the very, very narrow exceptions to the jealously guarded rule that a verdict is sacrosanct. And it is clerical error or some type of extraneous conduct that would cause that verdict to be tainted in some way. And what do we have here? And I don't want to take a lot of my time talking about the facts because I think they've been briefed. I'll hopefully be specific on who's who here. But we had an 8-week trial, an extensive trial. And I'll come to that later because we shouldn't have had to try the tortious interference part of it if the judge had thrown it out properly. The jury deliberated for 4 or 5 days. There was a special verdict form negotiated by counsel. The question is unambiguous. Nobody has ever contended up until, I believe, today that there was confusion on that verdict form. That's not an issue before this court, as best I can tell. Nobody could credibly argue that it is. The juror never said anything about confusion, either during the trial, while they were deliberating, or during the colloquy. The jury was discharged. We know what happened the day after. They were brought back, literally, I think it's 2 months later. Now,
counsel, is it your position the jury was discharged because the judge said so, or do we have to look at the what happened?
Well, I think, you know, it can become a little bit circuitous. I the way I read it is, when a judge says the jury is discharged, the jury is discharged. Now, there could be circumstances where perhaps those words are not meaningful. If in fact there are things the judge should have done, like in the Kinetic case, state versus, if we had a comparable statute, then I guess you could unwind it. But when he said it's discharged and took all of the actions that were consistent with that, the answer is yes. When he brought the jurors back for a colloquy, he didn't tell them that they were, you know, that the rule was rescinded. So I believe the record is that they were discharged and all the actions and conduct were consistent with that.
And also, counsel, as I suggested to Mr. Alioto, a judge doesn't typically meet with the jury privately without counsel if they're not discharged.
And I think, and clearly, he, you know, it would have put him in a horrible situation to be in there talking to the jury, then to have heard what he heard, and then to be very concerned, as I would have been as a judge, that what do I do with this? You know, it's like, ooh, I can't just walk away from it. So in one respect, he did what I think, and he's an extremely honorable, thoughtful guy, that let's figure out how do we get a clear record here so we don't have somebody second-guessing me. And of course, then he becomes a witness if that doesn't happen. But that doesn't undo a discharge in my view. Again, let's look at the facts. What the appellants are seeking here is to have the verdict rewritten. On what basis? I mean, certainly on nothing that I've argued so far is there any reason to do that. I mean, it would be totally flying in the face of policy and case law here, the rules that we have, the rules we have elsewhere, virtually every jurisdiction. But what do we have at best for the appellant? What we have is that in the polling, strike that, in the colloquy that happened, because he didn't re-poll them, in August in the August time frame of 2009, there were six of the jurors who said what they put down in the verdict form was what they intended. And then you've got some of the ones who clearly are saying, well, yeah, I said that, but I didn't mean it because we wanted to give them money. Well, that's wrong. So how do you rewrite a verdict on the basis of confusion, but certainly half of the jurors saying, I said what I meant, and the other half saying, well, I said what I meant, but it's not the result I wanted. That just doesn't work. I'm going to hit very briefly here the cases. I think, you know, I try to stay with the admonitions. Don't go repeating what's in the briefs, and I won't do that. But it was interesting to me to look at the appellant's opening brief on this, and I think the verdict issue is a big one. I think it's a huge issue, not in this case, but it's a huge issue that deserves the attention we're giving it this morning. And they cited to one case, really, Monopon. And, you know, there was no discussion of any other cases. It was almost notable by the lack of case law. And Monopon was, you know, there was never a discharge. It was a criminal case where the jury admitted that they botched. It was at least a clerical error where they signed the wrong verdict form, they didn't deal with the greater offense and entered a finding on the lesser offense. And the thing was a mess and it got fixed. And then the other case that they cite is State versus Pair, where the only argument there is that there was a violation by the judge of a state statute where he was mandated by the statute to individually poll jurors. That was the extent of it. Then in the reply, after we briefed, we get McCullough and Attridge. I'm not going to go back on them. I think they're not credible. They've been essentially disavowed in the federal system. They don't represent the better reasoned view, and clearly I've not seen many cases after the amendment to the rule that goes back there. So I don't see any reason that's really worth reconciling them. Cabral guides us here, and that case is clear on jurors trying to change results. And I would simply end where I started on this point, and that is I really urge you to please give us the clarity so that the next judges and lawyers who go through this will understand that you don't put the issues of discharge and confusion into a blender with the Rule 606. It's a very clear process, and the thinking process perhaps just needs to be further stated in bright lights so we know that that system works, and Lord Mansfield can rest happily in his grave knowing that. And then the other issue, I think, again on the verdict is, it's an abuse of discretion standard, and I'm not going to spend much time on it because I don't think we have to go there, but there's nothing to suggest here that Judge Cardoza either exceeded the bounds of reason or disregarded the law. In fact, I think he was more than precise and more than conservative and probably did a lot more on the colloquy part than a lot of judges might like to do. I'm going to turn briefly to, if I might, unless there's questions, to the other points, and I'm going to be fairly brief on those because I do want to. 6 minutes, okay. So I want to complete the balance of rebutting Mr. Alioto's points and then just start the beginning of our appeal. The point of error number two, which is the granting of the motion for judgment on the pleadings, And that has to do with the fiduciary duty. I listened to the questions. You can't, I don't care whether you call it a big F, a little F, middle-sized F on fiduciary duty, you don't create a fiduciary duty by somebody saying it. And if you look at the context of George Weir's testimony, it was essentially, look, did we have some kind of contractual obligation, not because of the option that existed on this property, not to do something inconsistent with that? And that's what he intended. But however you want to stretch it or torture that big F and little F, the fact of the matter is there could be no fiduciary duty in a contract like this, and it's a confusion between what is essentially a trust situation and a contract. We had a contract here. He had an option. His contract rights under the option, or Lahaina Fashion's contract rights under the option, were what they were. And saying it doesn't make it a fiduciary duty. The restatement is clear on that, and I won't spend more time on it. Exclusion of Exhibit 81, to me, or again, abuse of discretion, Judge Cardoza was absolutely right down the middle on it. Here we had a document that was a 2000 document that was attempting to be used by the plaintiff in the case to show there was fraud 6 years earlier. The document itself had 408 communications, and the judge properly found there was no probative value. There was no secret. We were trying to get the property back. There was a summary possession action that had been filed. There was a summary judgment motion. We chased Line of Fashions around, or predecessor counsel did. There was nothing probative about it and everything prejudicial about letting a 408 communication in. The last point that they've raised on appeal is the failure to expand the scope of the documents that they believe should have been given to them on the waiver of the attorney-client. And every case that I've read that's recent is very specific. You don't have a wholesale waiver of attorney-client privilege. You have a subject matter waiver. The judge took time to look at the documents, discern what was there, require us to respond to a very specific issue, and that issue related to the question that was asked that opened it up, and that was, what other parties expressed an interest in buying the property? He looked at it. That information was given to counsel, and it was tried. And again, we have abuse of discretion. So I think that ends my points on their appeal. And I'm just going to very briefly address what I said was, I thought, the second most important point, and that is real guidance from the court here on what is summary judgment and motion for, you know, judgment on the pleadings or judgment as a matter of law. This case, with respect to prospective interference or tortious interference, presents a record that's pristine. It is uncontradicted, and I'll go through it, if I may, on the remaining 5 minutes I'll have, but we cited in our cross-appeal all of the testimony at the trial court level back in 2000 and 2001 where Lahaina Fashions and Mr. Takeuchi, who retained not less than, I think, 5 or 6 counsel, made constant accusations about the bank specifically interfering with his option. And they went on record on pleadings, they went on record in front of Judge Boxa at hearings, and the judge, on the very last hearing, turned to counsel for Lahaina Fashions and said, look, you guys seem to be saying these guys, the bank, or the trust, is blocking your efforts to sell. They laid it out, they put an affidavit or a declaration in, and it was the very transaction that became the subject of this litigation that we just went through.
Counsel,
it was duplicate.
You recognize the difference between, and the trial court said there's a difference between what Mr. Takeuchi believed and what he knew.
Yes.
I take it that that's a difference that you don't believe existed in the case, though.
There's two levels here. The evidence that went in that were filings in the circuit court in the earlier matter in 2000, 2001 were not surmises. They were actually criticizing the very actions that became the subject of this lawsuit. And in June of 2001, in that case, there were filings with an affidavit by Mac Lawson, one of the ultimate buyers, who said, hey, the bank is messing me around on trying to close the deal. Well, this is what we spent 8 weeks trying in front of Judge Cardoza again. So it wasn't a belief. And then on cross-examination in front of Judge Cardoza, which was extensive, we went book, line, and verse. What did you know? What did you believe? What were the facts? And it was all based upon the same facts, the same parties. It wasn't speculation. It wasn't, gee, I think I have a claim. Am I up on my... Okay. Well, I'll reserve whatever I have left, but to address your question, Your Honor, I don't think the record at all has any semblance of, gee, I had a suspicion. But the rule is pretty clear on the statute. It is, you know, whether he knew or should have known. And my God, I mean, had it all here. So I don't think it was, in fact, when he was questioned about this in his deposition and at the trial that we had, he was angry. He was going to get the bank. I mean, and basically he waited and waited and shopped around for counsel and finally sued, you know, some 6-7 years later. It was no mystery. And the same evidence that was used at the original action in front of Judge Boxa were the same stuff that showed up in front of Judge Cardoza. It's one for one. Thank you very much.
Good counsel. Mr. Aliotto.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to reserve any comment about Judge Mansfield later after these sessions. I'd like to direct the court's attention to two rules, obviously avoided by the defendants, and that is 49, which is discussed in the Duke case, which allows for correcting mistakes. I'd also like to direct the court's attention to Rule 606B, which does the same thing. And, of course, Rule 60, which specifically refers to mistakes. And the reason is that we understand that sometimes no one is infallible, and you want to try to get what is actually true. Also, I'd like to point out that the statements made by counsel, again, does not differentiate between questions as to what the verdict was, what the intent was, as distinguished from why. And it is absolutely incorrect that in this case there was any effort or any statement by any juror that what they wanted to do was to give money to contrary, they were asked simply, was that your verdict? The answer was no, it was not. In that situation, they are saying what their verdict was, not why, not their mental processes, not their theories, not the evidence, not how, nothing, what, and it wasn't. And they were polled and they didn't prove their so-called affirmative defense. I would also like to point out at page 18 of our brief, nothing was said with regard to the Supreme Court's decision in Hawaii, Hawaiian Supreme Court's decision with regard to fiduciary duty and how it is owed, and especially with regard to properties. And when they had this property, where we had that option, then having that, they had a fiduciary duty to us and their chief executive officer of the trust company admitted it. Secondly, so that we're aware of this, not only did the jury find unanimously that there was an interference, but that it was malicious and wanton and intentional. And when counsel brings up the court, we alleged a fraud on the court. And they brought up a summary judgment motion, and Judge Cardoza denied it. And that was because they withheld information from not only the Second Circuit Court, but also from the Federal Bankruptcy Court. And the only thing Judge Cardoza said was he wasn't going to deal with the federal issue because he didn't think he had jurisdiction. But as far as the fraud on the court in Hawaii, he did, and it was going to go to the jury, which it did. The Rodriguez case, Your Honor, is by the Supreme Court in New Mexico, and this is the one where the jury was discharged, but the court felt that that was not the discharge, that that didn't stop it if, as the court said, there was no outside influence. And that Supreme Court of New Mexico decided on April of 2006, and it cited as 139 New Mexico 450, 134 Pacific 3rd 737. With regard to the sanctity of the jury, as the court knows in Duck, the court specifically dealt with the Seventh Amendment and specifically dealt with the sanctity of the jury issue and said there was no problem when the jury was correcting a mistake and correcting what they did, not why they did it or how they did it. And if there's ever an example of the jury being questioned heavily, it's the Supreme Court's decision in Hawaii, which we cited to Your Honors, which is the Manapont case in 1989, about 7 years after the Cabral case. And the citation here, very important case, because it goes to the very edge of any question with regard to jury verdicts. And this is cited, the site that I have is just specific, it's 765 Pacific 2nd, 1091, 1989 case. And in that case, it was the robbery case, and the jury was confronted with whether there was first-degree robbery or second-degree robbery, and they were not to go to the second-degree robbery unless they had decided not guilty on the first. And the only verdict that was returned was not guilty on the second. Therefore, they must have found that it was not guilty on the first and not guilty on the second. The court, the jury said we made a mistake to the judge. And so they went back and they found guilty on the first and guilty, nothing on the second. So from not guilty to guilty, now it can't be worse than that. And especially when they were specifically instructed not to get to the second one unless the first one was not guilty. So it's a complete change, and it's a marking, it's a mistake. It's what they did. The court said that you could, that the court had the discretion to be able to continue that. The case that we cited to Your Honor where the judge went into the courtroom, went into the jury's room, is the Sixth Circuit. And there they talked about the custom of some judges who went into the jury room to thank the jurors for their service. And then at the time, the foreman asked whether the plaintiff would receive the entire amount. Now they're talking about money. That didn't happen here. And the court said the judge informed the jurors that because of the finding, McCullough was 50% contributory negligence, the $235,000 verdict would be reduced by 50%. They said that's not what we intended. The judge allowed them to change it because they had made a mistake. So I don't think, the notion that somehow judges now are going to be precluded from looking at jurors sideways, everybody knows the difference between, I think, an in-camera secret or special meeting just with the judge or the juries. Everybody knows that that would probably be, obviously, it shouldn't happen. But what did the judge do? What did he do? He came out and he reconvened the jury, all of them. He put them in front of all of us one at a time. And he asked them specifically, the only question he was asking, is this your verdict or not? And they said no. At least seven of them said no. Two of them didn't remember because it was 2 months since we had brought him back. But they're still under the judge's control. They're still not released. We haven't been able to talk to them. And we wouldn't. We asked to. They said no. Okay, no, they're not released. Fine. So, and in order to make clear about the record, this is no accusation about Judge Cardozo because he said over and over again, I have to be cautious here. I frankly don't know what the answers are here. And at the time, we were suggesting to him, well, if you're asking him what, that's fine. Why don't you ask him whether or not they actually saw it or whether they were just giving instruction? But it doesn't make any difference. They came in singly, by themselves, saying honestly that they had not discussed it with anybody. That they obeyed the judge's decisions. And having obeyed the judge's decisions, the question was very simple. And it wasn't it wasn't how did you do it? Why did you do it? It was, is this your verdict? The answer was no. I have to speak briefly about the documents. During the option, I'm not quite sure how much time I have, but
until the red light goes on.
As soon as the red light goes on, okay, go ahead. The option gave the right to Mr. Takeuchi, who's here with us today. Now, they're in their 80s, and the sisters are in their 80s, and we can do another 8-week trial, I suppose. But we can also have the judgment corrected. And I believe this court has the right to do it and simply say, I'm very sorry, but you didn't ask for a new trial. The jurors came in and said you lost on your affirmative defense, and you didn't ask for a new trial. So therefore, too bad, that's it. The jurors found in our favor all the way down, including the punitive damages and including the malice that was here. Now, they had an obligation to us because of this option that we could buy it back at the $6 million that we sold it to them. And if we got anything between $6 and $9 million, we would get that. And then we wouldn't share with them unless it was over the $9 million. They had offers, and they had internal documents saying we can sell this easily. And we can rent this easily. And they decided, don't do that. And this exhibit number 81 specifically says, don't do it when there was an offer to buy it. Don't do it. We want it. Keep it so we'll have it for fee. So the jury, when the jury found that this was malicious and intentional against these people, that's not been questioned. That hasn't been questioned. There's no question about whether or not the evidence supports it or anything like that. They want to try to get out on this very sad event that should not happen. And we think this court should and will reverse that and make sure that justice is done here and that it's a true verdict. It means what it says. It's not a false dictus, but it's very dus dictus, and that's what it has to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aliotto. Mr. Latu, rebuttal?
I have 5 minutes, and I may not use it all. I want to begin where Mr. Aliotto left off, and that is, this isn't a request for justice. This is a request to basically turn the jury system upside down and to try to characterize things for what they're not. We don't have a mistake here. Nobody said they were mistaken, except as to what the result of their factual finding was. So the injustice would be, and the injustice has been in part, that an institution which gets shot at a lot, and the banks get shot at a lot, and they'll probably get shot at a lot more as time goes on, that they are forced to defend claims like this, that once they go through the trial, even though the facts seem to be beyond dispute and summary judgment would have been appropriate, they go through the trial, they spend huge amounts of money to defend themselves, and a jury properly concludes, based upon all of the uncontradicted evidence in front of them, that clearly this plaintiff, this appellant, not only knew, not only surmised, absolutely believed that it had a claim and had articulated an intention to bring a claim back in 2000-2001 and didn't. Now, we can surmise a lot of things, but it appears clear from the testimony you couldn't find a lawyer to bring a claim, again, on the same facts. But whatever that is, it doesn't matter. So the jury did what the jury did right. They made a factual finding. Any other finding would have been ludicrous. There was no testimony at all in the record that would indicate that Mr. Takeuchi, who is the spokesperson, the life and blood of Lahaina Fashions, didn't mean what he said. And, Your Honor, when you asked the question about what, you know, belief versus new and what really triggers, what is our appeal, what triggers enough of the, quote, uncontroverted facts to allow for summary judgment or judgment as a matter of law, it was here. And I just went back to look at some of the pieces of the record, and I won't obviously bore you with a lot of them, but to draw the distinction between a surmise or a suspicion versus I'm angry, I know what they did, I have facts, it's the latter. And for example, in the initial case in 2001, just before Judge Boxa orally granted the bank's request for summary possession, there was an opposing affidavit submitted by Mac Lawson, one of the buyers, who essentially said exactly what was said in the trial before Judge Cardoza. Same documents, same arguments, and that was the bank is not cooperating in allowing me, Lahaina Fashions, to sell to a third party. That was the gist of the complaint. Hey, you're getting in our way. You're not being cooperative. We asked you to, we think we've got a buyer. Lawson was one. We're asking you to put a deed into escrow. The bank said, no. This has been going on for a year. Come up with your money, get the deal together. We'll give you a deed. We'll let you go ahead and sell. But that was the gist of the argument. Lawson submits a declaration back in 2001 to Judge Boxa contending that here's the exhibits, here's the letters from the bank that refused to do whatever. It's the same story that was spun in the last case in Maui in front of Judge Cardoza. So it was not in any fashion surmised. Mr. Takeuchi was asked at trial, he was asked in his deposition, whether it was his intention to bring a lawsuit based upon what he knew. Yes, it was. He said that in June 2000. He said that was his intention and his knowledge in June 2001. He said that after they basically blew off the Second Circuit and went to the bankruptcy court to stay it, that he had intentions and harbored in his heart the desire to bring an action and punish the bank for what he thought was getting screwed. And he said it. He said it a dozen times. So this wasn't one where he had some inkling. He was looking for lawyers. He was talking to third parties about how it happened. It was the same parties then as it was in the trial we had. So I'm beating a dead horse, but I would simply suggest rarely will you find a record as clear as this to tell the lower court that, yeah, it's okay to grant summary judgments. And in fact, sometimes it's justice is served by doing that rather than forcing a party who shouldn't have been dragged through it to go through an eight-week jury trial in Maui. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. O'Toole. Thank you again, Mr. Alioto. Have a pleasant trip home.
Thank you.
Thanks for being your guidance.